Good evening, friends. This is Franz Weinschenk here to welcome you to our weekly edition of Valley Writers Read. And I know you're going to enjoy our program tonight because we've got a really outstanding story for you by a fine writer, Clovis author Debbie Everson Barofka. Her story is entitled Remembrance, and it's centered around an accident which the father in the story suffered when he was only a baby. And so here she is, Debbie Everson Barofka, Remembrance.
Remembrance. The fragrance of baking in the house was one of the few comforts my mother provided during her chaotic marriage to my father. She made loaves of white bread on weekends, brushing the crusty brown tops with shortening, covering them with a dish towel, wet and wrung dry, to seal the moisture after they'd come from the oven. There was nothing better than a thick slice, spread with butter, just warm from baking. She was always tired, working full-time to support our family, but somehow still managed to make bread. I sensed her baking was as much an act of necessity as it was of hope, that somehow the baking of bread would erase the wrongs of the week and set all in order once more. The warm waves shimmering from the oven were prayers of a sort, prayers of a tired woman struggling not to lose faith. The bread from my father's side of the family, called lefse, was as flat and homely as my mother's bread was curved and inviting. Made of ground potatoes, milk, and flour, rolled thin, it was baked on a hot, flat griddle. When Grandma began, a film of flour covered the kitchen counter, causing the surface to become satiny slick. Her hands were dusted in white from working the dough, and smudges of flour clung to her damp forehead. First, the potatoes had to be peeled and boiled, then pushed through a dull metal pan with holes in the bottom called a ricer. The potatoes emerged on the other side, a mass of steaming, grainy spaghetti. The process was repeated several times until all the lumps were gone. Next, she would add the milk and butter and whip them until they were smooth. The last step was adding the right amount of flour so the dough could be formed into small balls, which were then rolled out on a floury board into approximations of circles. The trickiest part was lifting these onto the griddle without them breaking apart. If the potatoes were too dry, the lefse would break into pieces on the board. If too much milk was added, the dough was too sticky to roll. The job of moving the lefse to the griddle was accomplished with a long-handled piece of wood, about 2 inches wide and sanded round on the end and thin on the edges. The lefse stick usually hung on the side of the kitchen cabinet, its edges darkened with use, a homely tool for a humble bread. I remember always eating lefse at Christmas, smeared with butter, sprinkled with cinnamon sugar. My grandma's eyes would soften, her body relax, while she sat at the old Formica kitchen table. She would pour coffee, and its dark, metallic smell seemed the only one suited to the food before us. The warmth of the kitchen, the taste of that potato bread, and the Minnesota lilt of my grandma's voice are with me still. It wouldn't be until many years later, when I had children of my own, that I would feel the pull of my roots and the need to share tradition, some elemental remembrance of hazy family history. Only now, Grandma had been dead for some 10 years. My grandfather remained, but a kitchen man he was not. He had always been a distant figure, and I had never felt conversation had come easily between us. Consequently, he was not someone I could now call for something as intimate as a family recipe. There were so many years, so much unspoken, unasked, between us. I had not been able to fly up for Grandma's funeral, and I felt the best of my memories of my father's family were from her. Asking Grandpa for anything, even a memory as simple as and small as making lefse, was an uncertain proposition, and in the end, I decided against it. Revisiting memories from my father's side of the family conjured up so many emotions, regret and sorrow, I wasn't sure I lived enough life to take the stress of recollection just yet. While the lefse was a warm and simple fragment remainder from my childhood, its memory drew forth many more, compelling me to sort and sift through events long gone, and in so doing, grieve the loss of my father. He and my mother divorced when I was 10 and then conveniently disappeared from my life, a reverberating rip followed by a long silence. My first memories of my father are dim ones. Many of them still echo his ragged, raging voice. There were powerful reasons, as the filter of time and adulthood had taught me, but my memories are embedded in the cold terror of his wrath and how much he hurt my mother with his verbal tirades and his off-again, on-again approach to family life. He was a glowering presence even when he wasn't around. Dad was the oldest of four children, born to a Norwegian carpenter and a woman 6 years younger than himself. Grandpa, like many of his generation, came from a large family in Minnesota, one of 13 children. Life was hard, and his parents were original immigrants from the old country, tough as nails and determined to survive and prosper in the new land. Emotions were a luxury. Work was primary. In this climate, he grew to adulthood and took up his trade of carpentry. A hard worker with little spare money, he dated very little, and most of his social life occurred around Nordland Lutheran Church, sermons followed by hot dishes and jello salads. Then there was the 400 Club. It was a local monthly gathering in Hawick. Community folk put on plays and musicals, and sack lunches were served along with steaming coffee in tin mugs. When plays weren't being produced, the gatherings turned into town dances. All the benches would be pushed around the edges of the meeting hall, and the orchestra would play. Everyone danced. Mothers would wrap their babies in coats and sit them on the benches, and the older kids would dance with relatives and neighbors. It was here he first spied Grandma, only 18 years to his 24. He was smitten, and he worked up the courage to ask her into town the following month. It was December in Minnesota. Cold, dark, and snowy. By the time they made their way back to her house that evening, the snow was falling so hard they couldn't see 3 feet in front of themselves. He had to hole up with her family for the next 4 days. By the time the storm had passed, he had proposed to her, and she accepted. They were married within the week. In early September, just as the fall harvest was coming in and Grandpa had finished work on a neighbor's new roof, my dad was born. Named Clinton Clifford Everson, after his father. His birth coincided 9 months to the day from that snowy Christmastime proposal. I wonder now at how it all came to pass, whether they had to get married, or whether Dad was really a honeymoon conception. At any rate, Grandpa's life changed drastically inside of that year's time. He had a pretty young wife and a brand new son. But the baby caught a cold. Babies do, especially during those first chilly weeks of early fall. The cold progressed to bronchitis. He was only 3 weeks old. The doctor recommended steam tenting to help him breathe more easily. I can only imagine how Grandma coped with the circumstances. She never spoke of it. It must have been frightening to be cooped up with an infant who was constantly coughing and sucking for breath. She was young, only a few months past her 18th birthday when my father was born. What she knew of raising children came from her own experience with her younger brothers. Now she had a baby of her own, in his crib, tented with a pan of boiling water, a makeshift vaporizer. The doctor had been severe. "Don't let this baby catch a draft. He'll have pneumonia, and he's already weak." What happened next became the event that shaped the years ahead without mercy. No one, even my aunts or uncles, would speak of it as adults. The sketchy facts, gleaned from a great aunt's conversation with my mother, were all I had to go by. It must have been grisly. The baby screamed and screamed, and by the time she got there, the steaming water had parboiled his feet, his calves, his legs. Where had they been? Why didn't they hear him? Why didn't they come? The questions have rattled and echoed around in my head as long as I can remember, especially since the birth of my own children. How tautly I had been poised for any minute variation in movement, acutely aware of their helplessness. I felt so clumsy, but the fierceness of my desire to protect them both surprised and reassured me. My great aunt's version was almost more than I could have imagined. Where were my grandparents? My grandmother had been pinned to the mattress. My grandfather had his needs. He would not be interrupted. not by a wife just recently initiated by birth, not by the cries of a new baby. My God, the horror of that moment must have been immeasurable. The smell of burned flesh, the steam, the heap of baby blankets flung on the floor, water steaming, soaking into the wooden floorboards, forever warping what it touched, the guilt seared in hearts as deeply as the water had burned flesh. The neighbors got them to the hospital, where they were told the extent of the burns were so severe, Dad's legs would need to be amputated, just below the knee, both little legs. The year of great joy had just become the year no one would speak of. Somehow, this baby survived the multiple surgeries, skin grafts, and bone revisions, despite his weakened respiratory system. He surprised everyone with his energy and determination. He crawled. He tried to climb. He was like any other one-year-old, but without legs. His parents were zombie-like in their grief. Eventually, he was fitted with artificial legs. They were made to measure at the Shriners Hospital in Minneapolis, scooped out about 8 inches on the inside to accommodate the special white wool stockings and his narrow, smooth, pink stumps. Miniature wooden limbs with carved wooden heels. Grandma would hold them on her lap at night, caressing the rigid feet that could never move, and cry softly for hours. In time, he walked. He ran. He got into things. The extended family and friends from Nordland Lutheran breathed a collective sigh of relief. Maybe, just maybe, things would turn out all right for Clinton after all. A part of my grandfather must have died. He could not bear to look at my father or his wooden limbs. The shame of his accident would grow, and in time the seeds of their self-hatred grew deep, twisting roots, and the dance of their relationship began its intense, complex pattern. I love you. I hate you. I love you. I hate you. I sense the undercurrents between them, even as a child. About a year and a half after Grandma died, Grandpa remarried. He was at a total loss for how to care for himself in the most mundane of household tasks. Once again, he returned to Minnesota and the family farm for some measure of guidance and comfort. This woman, recently widowed, was from the same little farming community near Painesville, as Norwegian as he was, by all accounts, a former teacher of both Sunday school and piano, mother of three grown children, a member of the Lutheran Church, and a long familiarity with Grandpa's family and their place in the community. She told me later of his indirect proposal. So, will you come with me over the mountain? Baking lefse warmed the kitchen once again. It was comfort food for them. The older they got, the more often they ate of it. 4 years into his second marriage, Grandpa was diagnosed with cancer. He resisted it every step of the way, taking all manner of drugs and procedures with his typical stoicism. I'm fine. The first treatment seemed to go well, and he was given good news from his doctors at successive checkups. I remember feeling relieved at the reprieve from his chemotherapy routine. I knew that he had to have been in much more pain than he would ever let on to any of us, save maybe Ruth, his wife. They continued to take car trips from Oregon to Arizona and Minnesota. He continued working in his woodshop and tending a small herd of sheep in the pastures that surrounded their home in rural Oregon. Letters from Ruth became more medically specific, filled with more requests for prayers on his behalf. He was dying. He was my last living grandparent, and the reality of his passing began to settle in my bones. I ached. I thought of Jacob asking for a father's blessing before parting. I decided to write. I wasn't sure he'd respond. I was the firstborn of a son who had brought him so much grief. But I kept it brief and made an offhand request. Dear Grandpa, if it's not too much bother, do you think you could make me a lefse stick? I've gotten a recipe, but I need a stick. I'd be happy to pay you for a cost of materials and postage. Let me know. Within 2 weeks of the letter, a slender package arrived in the mail, wrapped in thick brown paper and taped many times around. There was no note, just two slender rectangles, one of white wood, probably fir, and one of darker wood with a grain of pecan. They had both been sanded smooth and thin at the edges and tip. There were holes drilled in the handles for hanging. I turned the wood in my hands slowly, feeling the satin of the wood just as he must have done when finishing them. I held them lightly, palms up, receiving the blessing I'd finally requested, finally received, but my heart was heavy. When the call came from my uncle, I wasn't at home. The details were few. Grandpa had died earlier in the day at a nursing care center. The funeral would be on Monday, 2 days before Thanksgiving. When my father died, I remembered Grandpa's cryptic words. There were worse people. But his eyes and voice spoke more than any words he could utter. The grief and pain of his eldest son's life bowed him once again. My grandmother, still living at the time, coped by washing dishes in the sink. She didn't shed a tear that I saw. They had been wrung out of her years before. At the time, I had been 24, and their response to his death puzzled and confused me. I had expected clear-cut grief, not these obscure silences. But now, somehow, they made more sense. The weather flying out of our local airport in Central California fit my mood. The clouds were low and gray, the light opaque. I clenched my teeth as I climbed into the tiny cabin for the commuter flight to San Francisco. It was such a small plane that from my window seat I could see into the cockpit, over the pilot's shoulder and through his window shield. I felt the familiar lump of cold dread coalescing in the pit of my stomach, surreal numbness taking me limb by limb. Leaving the ground, to see objects from such a distance that they seem like so many kids' Lego blocks, to see the surface of the countryside reduced to quilt-like proportions, up there, above the clouds, there's nothing I can do if a bolt comes loose. I don't do it well, at all. After the initial takeoff, we became blanketed in a dense, cottony fog. I was spared the view of the earth below and instead closed my eyes and let the internal monitor of my mind's eye begin to flicker. The last time I had seen my grandfather was 2 years ago. We had traveled up to Oregon after the birth of our second child. There had been a small baby boom in the family. Three of us cousins had all had babies within a six-month period of each other. Grandma Ruth had invited us all out to their house for a potluck. I wondered how he felt in the midst of all these grandchildren with their new babies. We took pictures of him holding each of them on his lap or in his arms. To look at the pictures, he was a venerable patriarch, uncomfortably bemused by all this attention. Funny, though, that I'd never seen any pictures of him in similar poses with my dad or any of his own children. What to make of this next generation and their offspring? All these hugs and all this talk. Surely the bloodline was thinning. Stoicism was in retreat, thanks to the infusions from different gene pools. I had laughed at my uncle's remark to that effect. I shut my eyes for most of the flight, trying to keep rein over the waves of emotion that threatened to engulf me and reduce me to puddles of water in the presence of strangers. I couldn't let go of the disappointment in my extrasensory self. I had been sure that I would know the moment when my grandfather died. He was my last link to my father. I thought surely I would have the sensation of something, I don't know what, that would tug at me and break me away from whatever momentary pursuit held my attention. And at that moment, I would know he had died. Instead, his death had happened enigmatically. It had been an ordinary work day. I had been involved in my most ordinary work. He died, and I hadn't sensed a thing. It was a relief to see my sister's face at the airport terminal. As usual, she was quivering with the effort of holding together the multiple crisis du jour of the family circle. Our grandfather's death had come at a time when our younger brother was going through a wrenching custody battle for two of his daughters. The court dates were pending just 2 days away, and so was Thanksgiving. So much present circumstance was unearthing so many past hurts already. As we drove from the parking structure, I rolled down the window and drank in the wet, pungent smell of evergreen, grass, and river. There is no place like home, as if my bones hold the memory of their first meeting with this earth, this life. I carry it with me. In all my comings and goings, for all the heartaches and regrets, there will never be another place that resonates and soothes me as this geography does. The land is curved, carved through by a river, the backdrop a snow-peaked Mount Hood and the distant Cascade Range. It's always green. It fairly shimmers in its rain-soaked self. As a child, I never noticed that most days were inevitably accompanied by gray skies because of the rich depths of green. I drank them with my eyes, and the colors fed my soul. I let my breath out slowly and then filled my lungs. It had been a week drenched by rain, and the air was sweet with the scent of wet wood, leaves, dirt. We drove to my sister's home, catching up on details of our family lives we don't usually get to share. Big news like who is potty trained now, who is reading, who is resisting our latest attempts to be competent parents. It amazes me how much we have in common now that we have kids, especially since our childhood had seen so much gore from Survival of the Fittest. I'm both thankful and relieved that time has served to draw us close together. She had cleared a spot for me to sleep in the den downstairs amid the kids' Nintendo controls, Legos, and exercise equipment. I dumped my bag and shook out the dress I'd brought to wear. I hung it on the doorframe. In one of those odd moments of clarity, I saw it on a rack while I was on my way doing an errand. I don't usually find a dress without trying on an armful, but I knew I'd wear this one to his funeral. I just knew. There was a pot of soup on the stove, and the aroma of chicken stock and vegetables wove through the house. So did the unmistakable fragrance of a warm bread. She has one of those new modern conveniences, a bread maker, a contraption that requires you only to pour in basic ingredients and poof, 4 hours later, you have bread. At least it smells like bread. It comes out in a stunted little rectangle. I can't help but wonder about these things we keep inventing, so much focus on speed and efficiency. Part of me feeling a bit lost, looking for tradition and mourning its ghost. In the end, though, we're still baking bread, still acknowledging communion, so what should it matter how we make it? The viewing. That's what Ruth had called it. That night at 8 p.m. at the funeral home. We knew it was important to her. We promised we'd be there. I knew there would be relatives I hadn't seen since my father's death some 12 years before. My father had two younger brothers and a sister. I was sure they'd hung the moon and stars in the sky when I was small. My parents' divorce served to stunt my perceptions. They were, for a long while, frozen in my mind's eye, as they had been when I was 10 years old. I hadn't seen most of them again until my wedding day, and I remember being shocked at their height, at their very ordinariness. They had gone on to have families and children, and in the meantime, I had grown up and moved away. I closed my eyes and felt the old ache of family loss, dull and deep in my chest. I knew the sight of their hairlines, the way it receded at their temples from an early age, their plump cheeks, the blue eyes. I knew these features would call back my father's presence, and just as surely, when they saw me, he would stand before them. This family is not good with words. The fewer, the better, it seems. So much unsaid over so many years. The differences between us had grown beyond mere conversation. Even so, I welcomed the opportunity to be among them for a time. There is something about seeing the flesh of kin that is like looking into Narcissus' pool. I know that somehow, if I look long and hard enough, I'll find lost parts of myself. We arrived at the funeral home in the dark. It was a Sunday evening, and the streets of this rural town were deserted. The only lights on the block were the street lamps on the corner and the parking lots on the side of Malala Funeral Home. The building was an old single-story house with a wide porch on the front. We climbed the wide cement steps to reach the door. The entry had been left, as one would expect, with room to chat once inside and a place to hang coats if needed. The former kitchen, off to the right, had been remodeled as an office. It was closed off now by a solid wood door. Off to the left, the wall ended, and the tiny hall turned to the center of the building, where the chapel was located. It had been furnished with 8 rows of plain pine benches and a small lectern in the front. There were several vertical windows with deep sills which opened to a view of a small side street. As we entered, we were greeted by Ruth, Grandpa's second wife. She was pale, her skin glowing with a soft blue tint. It was obvious she was tired, but she felt solid as she hugged me. I'm so sorry about your grandpa, girls. Odd words for her to speak. It was she who had been his companion for the last 10 years, with all she'd weathered, the chemotherapy, the ebbing away of the man she'd married, the condolences belonged to her. He's in there. Please go on. I hope you'll have good memories. We entered to find my aunt and her 2 daughters near the front of the chapel by the casket. We hugged, sobered in the presence of death. There was no polite small talk. We all seemed to know why. This man, whom we had come to mourn, had been a source of so much conflict between his wife, his children, even his grandchildren. He had, for the most of his life, remained a stubborn survivor. It was hard to believe he was really gone. I stared down at him. His cheeks were not as plump as I remembered. His gray hair, still curly, was combed in soft waves. Though his skin was spotted with age and he had weathered the agonies of cancer, he looked remarkably like himself. And yet there was something missing. It took a few minutes to realize it was his glasses. They had framed his eyes in all my recollections of him. Without them, he looked oddly vulnerable. I found myself speaking out loud. "You old fart! You cranky old fart!" Words stuck in my throat. "We just wanted you to pay attention. Say something. How could you die now? I want to know more about you. I need to know about my father. You're the only one who could tell me the truth. I never had the nerve to ask. Why couldn't anyone ever talk to each other in this family anyway?" I jammed my hands deep in my coat pockets and stepped back from the coffin. My aunt's voice made me jump. "Good for you. He was an old fart. He was so ashamed of how Clint was crippled. He'd never got over it. It was a big wedge between him and Mom. She loved Clinton so much, but Dad, he wouldn't put up with any show of it around the house. 'What's done is done,' he'd say. When we were small, he always took the road back to Minnesota whenever he had a problem he had to work out. He'd just up and go, leave Mom alone with us 4 kids to fend for ourselves until he got things sorted out." For the next hour or so, we stood and took turns exchanging pieces of the kaleidoscope of our mixed histories. Shards and jewels, the click and focus of abuse, divorce, addiction, births, remarriage, hope. It was clear none of us had escaped unscathed, and just as clear that none of us had the answers. How little life changes from one generation to the next. The day of the funeral broke bright with sunshine. The sky was true dream blue, and the clouds broke apart, leaving the morning bathed in clear winter light. It was cold. I wore my coat to the service and didn't take it off. The little chapel filled slowly. Organ music floated in and out of my awareness. The family was given a private space to the right of the lectern and the casket. People filtered in, hesitant to take their places. Ruth was left in the front row, the chair beside her empty. Both of my uncles and their families had chosen to sit outside the designated area. Behind Ruth were the ragged remnants of the rest of the family, those of us tainted by divorce and other observable social disgraces. My aunt with her children and grandchildren, my 2 brothers, 2 sisters, and my mother. Mom hadn't seen many of these relatives since her own divorce from my father over 25 years ago. The room was filled with griefs, both old and new. I took the chair beside Ruth and asked her if it was all right with her. She squeezed my hand and the service began. The pastor was a portly young Lutheran. His clerical collar appeared uncomfortably tight, and his face was forced pink as he spoke. It was a familiar ritual, the Our Father, What a Friend We Have in Jesus, and Amazing Grace. He cleared his throat and began the memorial. He read a history of Grandpa's life. Some of the facts were new to me. I hadn't known he'd worked for a tool company for 13 years. But then I hadn't known so many things about him. Similar threads he and my father had shared. I'd never really seen the similarities until then. Neither could tolerate routine. Both felt the need to be in control of the moment. Neither could take being told what to do by anyone else. They did what they wanted, the way they wanted to do it, despite the toll it exacted on those around them. Words from the New Testament surfaced intermittently as I was caught up in the twin tides of memory and recognition. First my father's face, then my grandfather's, and then my daughter's. What to make of our genes and my family inheritance of blue eyes and stubborn survival? There was music again, a woman's voice spilling over the edges of rock of ages. Then the service was over. The side doors facing the streets were opened. The sunlight streamed in, and those who had come to say goodbye got the last chance to do so. They filed past Grandpa's open casket, some averting their eyes, some lingering, some touching the casket sides in final gestures. It was mostly an older crowd. Many of them walked slowly and required help at the elbow to manage the door and the steps out and down into the parking lot. I stood off to the side. Most of the respectable parts of the family were already outside. They needed the air. From behind me, I heard my aunt's voice. I don't know how many times I've said goodbye to that man, and now I've got to do it again. Her voice broke. I met her eyes, and for a moment we were ageless, one orphan daughter to the other, aware only of the ache of an absent father. My younger uncle, Dennis, put his arms around her as she cried. His face was one of detached sorrow, a man attempting to give comfort in a family where there had been so little. Standing before the coffin one last time, I studied my grandfather's face, the one I claimed so much as my own. I felt tears of regrets, too many to name, slip out one by one. I turned to face the door and walked out into the sunshine. The road to the cemetery wound through the back roads of the town, through farm property and Christmas tree acreage. It became a gravel drive as we neared the entrance. The gate was black iron, a simple arch. Adams Cemetery, established 1819. The procession made its way through the grounds to the end of a long gravel loop. We came to a stop. The gravesite was on the southwest edge of the property. There were pastures and valley as far as the eye traveled, and in the distance the mountain range rose, snow-capped. It was quiet. We took our places around the grave, the pewter color of the coffin glinting in the sun. Ruth had chosen the casket spray. It was centered on top, and the rust, yellow, gold of the lilies and daisies drank in the light. I wondered what his thoughts were in choosing this place instead of Minnesota. Ruth had said it was because he wanted to be closer to his family, but it didn't fit with the rest of what I knew. His life was much more complicated than those still living. What of all those ties to his own place of birth? Perhaps his own memories of his life had become more elemental, distilled with the passage of time. Maybe his thoughts were with his children more in the last years of his life. I don't know. He never said. For the moment, I was grateful for the green beauty and the peacefulness surrounding us, grateful for the moment to reflect on a journey ended. I looked at the faces around me, those I knew and those I didn't, aware of travels yet unfolding, all headed in different directions, aware that for just this moment we were converged in contemplation of one man's passing, one life, a common bloodline, unspoken pain, memories both intertwined and inexplicably separate. A snapshot of family. Mine. Back at the house, we gathered to eat and visit. The ladies of Woodburn Lutheran had set up extra card tables to make places for the crowd. People milled tightly through the kitchen, living room, and hallway. Food was set out, along with extra folding chairs in the garage. Families clustered together in small knots, occasionally breaking apart to accommodate conversation from those passing through. Smaller children jostled impatiently and bumped along the edges of adults trying to maintain some sense of decorum appropriate to the situation. There had been a death, after all. In the center of one of the tables in the garage was a plate of lefse. It was cold. Ordinary, plain, scorched a little around the edges, but it was all I could manage to eat. That and some coffee. My eyes felt burned into their sockets after too little sleep and too many emotions. I found a corner in their small living room and sat down. I watched the people ebb and flow out of the room into the front yard. The sunlight was generous and gold. Folks stood chatting without their coats, despite the cold. Looking out the front window, the view of the pastures was soothing. The expanse of the gentle hills served as a cool compress to my forehead. Ruth came in and sat down in a chair next to me. Her skin was papery, white. A vein throbbed on the side of her temple. Her eyes were rimmed red. She glanced at my plate. "I see you found the lefse." It was all I was up to at the moment. "Your grandpa, he helped make that batch. We put up the extra in the freezer. He liked to have it with his coffee in the morning." I saw him in the kitchen, turning the flatbread he'd known from his own childhood, a familiar ritual, one blessed by his own mother's hands. The bread, the communion with his own history, the memories of the farm in Minnesota, ordinary things, ordinary folks. It was enough to remind him of the price of survival, enough to give him hope for the strength to persevere. I broke off another piece and ate it slowly.
That was Debbie Everson Borofka reading Remembrance. She continues a kind of melancholy tradition often associated with Scandinavian writers and composers. So, as we listened to the story tonight, we were sort of reminded of the music of Jan Sibelius, the plays of Henrik Ibsen, or perhaps the movies of Ingmar Bergman. There is all that silence and non-communication in the family she writes about. As we heard, the story is dominated by a singularly tragic accident that happened to the narrator's father shortly after he was born. Only 3 weeks old, he caught bronchitis, and the family put a tent over the baby's crib with a pan of boiling water inside, an old-fashioned kind of steam inhalator. However, the boiling water spilled over in some way and hopelessly scalded the baby's tiny legs. And where were the parents? The narrator asks, and answers her own question. My grandmother had been pinned to the mattress since my grandfather had his needs. It is this pitifully painful event which forever taints and haunts the history of this family. And isn't it true that we often read about terrible accidents like that? A child at play shooting one of his playmates, thinking the gun wasn't loaded. Or a relative carelessly backing up over a youngster in a driveway. Our hearts go out to the victims, as of course they should. But what about the kid that pulled the trigger? Or the driver who didn't bother to look? Sure, they didn't mean it, but it happened just the same and can never be made right again. And the perpetrators have to live with such horrible memories. Maybe that's why the grandfather in the story was so non-communicative and scarred. Sitting there all alone, eating his solitary lefse bread. Friends, we've had the pleasure of featuring Deb Everson Borofka on our show for quite a few years. She always has a fine story to tell us, and tonight was no exception. It's no surprise that her story tonight was published in the Crabtree Orchard Review, and that she was a finalist in the John Guion Literary Nonfiction Competition. We're also pleased to announce that not so long ago she earned her PhD. Congratulations. We want to thank her for all of her many contributions and certainly hope she'll send us more of her fine prose in years to come. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online to kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, our author will be Jim Benelli. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.